Hello.
And welcome to episode 17 of Season to Taste. We've got a pretty damn pat now, haven't we? My name's Will.
Hello, Will. I'm Matt.
In the last episode of Doctor Who and the Season to Taste, the randomizer sent us to series 3 of what we call New Doctor Who, as opposed to Nude Doctor Who. That's something very different. And we chose the story Gridlock, with perhaps the slight spoiler of mentioning that it's awesome. So, now that we've watched Gridlock, Matthew, what did you think?
It's quite an interesting story, isn't it? It starts off with a couple on their way, apparently to a Rocky Horror convention, dressed in the American Gothic costumes, and they're travelling, and the whole thing is a story that's constantly on the move. It's constantly got the cars zooming about, or not zooming about that much when they're on the motorway, but the Doctor jumping about between cars as well. So, given that it takes place on about 3 sets, it's an astonishingly fast-moving and pacey story, and probably a kind of masterclass in how to do Doctor Who on a budget, because presumably all those cars are exactly the same set, slightly redressed.
You see 6 or 7 different cars that are all just the same prop.
The other thing that I noticed about it was Russell T. Davies is famously interested in vertical storytelling, so a lot of his stories take place in tower blocks or kind of go up and down between floors rather than running around corridors. So although there's lots of running about, it's not running around corridors, it's jumping up and down between the different levels of the motorway.
Yeah, I think we've mentioned it slightly before, haven't we? And it happens in New Earth, which is the last one set on New Earth.
Yeah.
When they're going up the hospital and they're being chased by Cassandra up the ladder, or they're being chased by the zombies up the ladder, and Cassandra's in there. Which, one of many similarities with that story. Now, all those drugs have the Crescent logo of the hospital. Mm. Obviously, we have a return of the face of Bo, and we're back on New Earth, much to Martha's annoyance when she realises that Rose has been there before.
Yeah. So I think everything seems to be always on the move. And I thought it was quite interesting. The Doctor spends most of the episode running after Martha, having spent the first couple of scenes running away from her. When you watch that first TARDIS scene where he's offering her a chance for one more trip, he doesn't touch her, and she kind of follows him around the console, and he's always keeping the console in between him and her as though he doesn't want to get too close. And I think that's really interesting because obviously he's still, as Martha says, on the rebound from Rose, so he's obviously trying to not let himself get too close. But Tennant, I think, really cleverly makes that a really physical and obvious thing, so he kind of runs out the door and Martha has to chase after him. And
yeah, there's no holding hands running out, is there?
No, the Doctor, it feels very much like he likes Martha, but he doesn't want to get to know her too well, because I think he half intends all the time to drop her off as soon as possible. And there's just something about her that means that he can't quite bring himself to do that. But it's not right until the end, when the face of Bo dies, that the Doctor actually puts his arm around Martha and you sense any, you know, real warmth from the Doctor, other than the regret that he's got this young woman into trouble.
It's an incredibly sad, emotional story as a whole, and obviously, you know, it's very intentional, but there's the moments of deliberate heartstring pulling, like the hymn, which is just something that you don't imagine Doctor Who doing at all. It comes completely out of left field, and it should by rights be incredibly mawkish and horrible, and actually it's a really powerful, gentle moment of uniting all these characters. And actually, just as you have, you know, Branigan saying to the Doctor, you know, you don't know us at all, you come barging in, you think you know what the situation is. And he has, you know, the Doctor's touched a nerve, because there's all these people getting on, making the best of their lives, having families, all with their kind of ambitions, but he kind of points straight to this darkness and this secret that none of them, they all know something's wrong. And none of them want to face up to it, because if they faced up to it, they'd go mad. They, they're stuck on a motorway with no hope. And their way of clinging onto that hope is not recognising it. And he pierces their bubble, but actually doesn't see that they are one big community. You know, all their little Facebook chats between the cars.
Yeah, the doctor shows no real sympathy towards them.
No, and when that happens, when they're singing the hymn, and you feel the power of it anyway, because it's just shot and done, achieved beautifully, but you have Martha completely enveloped in it to the point that she's trying to mouth along to it, and, you know, is in tears, and the doctor is absolutely stoic. He's kind of just watching in a detached interest. He's kind of bemused and intrigued, but there's no emotion at all.
Yeah, maybe he doesn't lack sympathy, maybe he lacks empathy.
He does
sympathise, he feels sorry for them, but he can't empathise with the fact that they're not taking action or doing anything
situation. His automatic response is to try and fix it. That's what he does. And he can't imagine people just settling for that. And all that kind of repression is what comes out at the end, and you have this Zot himself, this beautiful, sad moment as he realises, you know, the deceit that he's played on Martha for his own understandable but slightly selfish ends.
I think the ending, the ending is very sad, and it's a lovely scene and a beautiful moment as the Abide With Me kind of swells in the background and the doctor's giving this lovely, I think he's repeating what Susan said about Gallifrey in the very silver first leaves. Series, although seconds before I did notice he's an utter bastard to Martha, where she says, "Oh, the face of those final words, what did he mean? You're not alone. Did he mean that you've got me?" And the doctor just laughs in her face. I don't, the ridiculousness of it.
I don't think he's that.
I think he comes across as really callous.
No, I don't. I think he's, there's no way of saying to her, you know, he's kind of wryly amused, and he's trying to give her his like sweet smile and saying, I don't think it is. And yet it's a little bit patronising, but it's slightly optimistic of her to think that's what the face of Bo, the face of his last secret.
She does take the hump when he says it, to be honest. She's not too impressed. And quite right, too. I mean, he's not exactly treating Martha very well in this story.
No.
So I think he deserves the bit of ear-chewing that he gets.
Yeah, and she does deserve to be treated better, because she, as you see across the whole of this season, she's always written very clever. She's always asking the right question. She's actually always coming up with the answer. I think pretty much every story has to do something medic-y in. So in this one, it's ripping the honesty sticker off the pregnant woman.
Mm.
Quite why someone who's been spending time alone with her boyfriend stroke husband feels the need to wear an honesty sticker.
Mm.
I don't know. I don't know what's happening in that, really. It's not like she can be having an affair with another car, is it? So it's slightly, it's a bit of a plot-driven moment that she's wearing that at all. But, Martha gets that moment of medicine. But, she's the one who says, who saves them. She's the one who says, turn off the power, and kind of works out how to avoid the macro.
Yeah.
Because it is the macro, which is still just an amazingly... It's that thing, you know, this is the third series. And after all, you've had two series where they can kind of bring back high-profile old monsters. And the show's reached a point where he can have the confidence to just go, screw it, we'll have the macro.
Yeah, well, that's true. I think if they did this these days, then the forums would be buzzing with rumours that must mean that therefore they found the macro terror and they're doing it as a nod because they've discovered those episodes. Because I think, you know, the great intelligence was in series seven, and all the forums were buzzing saying, oh, well, they must have found the web of fear. Because otherwise, why would they use the Great Intelligence? And clearly, the Web of Fear hasn't been returned to the BBC, so it's just a nonsense. It doesn't mean anything. It's just that they want to use a rubbish old villain for a bit of a laugh.
I like Russell just going, oh, do you know what? I think I'm going to use the map. I did actually, as we were watching it, picture Russell going, oh, I've got to, you know, driving down to Cardiff, going, oh, I've got to come up with an idea for a story now, and I should be working on the story, and I can't because I'm stuck in the bloody M6 gridlock. Wait!
And must get those crabs treated.
Wait. And I must feed the kittens. Wait. And I must powder my giant face. Wait.
Oh, look, I'm shrouded in my own smoke.
Wait.
Oh, look, there's a man in a bowler hat driving a car.
Wait.
Oh, look, there's a cat driving a car. What's in this cigarette?
Hang on. There are cars above me and below me, and I'm in New York, and there's crabs down below, and... Oh, no, I've just fallen asleep. it's always possible he's just an incredibly inventive man who comes up with crazy, crazy ideas.
It could be. But I like the idea that it's just all sodded. We'll put the macro in, that'll be a laugh. And I think Great Intelligence falls into that category of a slightly rubbish Patrick Troughton monster. Albeit... To be fair, they did name UNIT after the Great Intelligence, didn't they? So it can't be that rubbish.
Did they?
Well, the United Nations Intelligence Task Force. Presumably it's a task force set up to fight the Great Intelligence.
I thought
that's the only thing they've ever fought.
Yeah, although, I mean, there is a slight difference to the Great Intelligence. The Great Intelligence is in two stories in the 60s, and is one of those...
Yeah, I suppose. I'm being facetious.
This was one of those villains that fans very much like. Oh, the whole joy of the macro, like when people say, let's bring back the quarks. it's very much about something you never imagine anyone going out. I think pretty much every monster has been brought back in some kind of spin off thing now, hasn't it? But the fact that the high profile Saturday Night glossy new series decides to use giant crabs is a joy.
I don't think the chameleons have come back. I might be incorrect, but I'm pretty sure they haven't.
Or have they? Ah.
You poor fool. And the monoids have never come back.
Let's not discuss the monoids, because we're only...
Oh, no, they have actually. They're in a Bernice Summerfield audio.
I kind of thought so. I couldn't believe that Big Finish would not at some point have used
monoids. I don't think
they're
racist in that. I would hope not, because I think it was written by... someone who isn't racist.
I think that's quite likely that they're not in that. Well, I mean, I mentioned Martha kind of being clever throughout the season, and actually this story does a really good job of hooking into the season as a whole. I mean, from the little things like the Doctor talking about the Time War and telling Martha about the Daleks at the end, the moment before she meets them in the next story.
Yeah, that's lucky.
You know, the face of Beau's message is intrinsic to... the arc of the season, the description he gives of Gallifrey is the Gallifrey we see in The Sound of Drums, flashback to the Master's youth. The Last of Time Lords is obviously the last story of the season. Mm-hmm. It kind of is very tied into where the season's going, and human nature and utopia also link together. It's actually the most, for all this, that Mr. Saxon is the one who kind of pops up and is the name we hear in them. Actually, we don't hear him in this one.
Mm.
Actually, as a close-knit story arc, more than any other this season, is an ongoing story as Martha's relationship with the Doctor changes and develops, and this whole Last of the Time Lord plot unfolds.
Mm. That's true. I think the Face of Beau thing is very, very clever, because it was foreshadowed even as far back as Series 1. I'm pretty sure in the Christopher Eccleston, I think it's called Monsters and Villains or something, there's a book, and it has little... bit about monsters and villains from the classic series and the new series, and it's got a page on the Face of Beau, and there's a little sidebar written by Russell T Davies, and it says something like, legends say that the Face of Beau is billions of years old, and if he should ever die, then the sky will crack open, which obviously it kind of does when the motorway cracks open, and it says something like, and he will speak his dying words to a lonely traveller or something like that. So Russell was obviously thinking along those lines right the way back in 2004, 2005, when the series originally came back. So it's a nice little payoff for anyone who was paying attention there.
And I like to think the Doctor's read that book. So when Novice Haim says, oh, and then there's the prophecy, and the Doctor goes, look, we don't have to do that.
Yeah.
It's like, he knows that there's a prophecy, he's read the monsters and
he's got monsters and villains in his TARDIS library.
I mean, he's got the whole collection in the TARDIS library, hasn't he? He has got the Macro Terror in there, that's how he knew all about that.
Yeah.
But also, obviously, you know, they forked out for blooming great face of bow prop. Why not use it two more times after the end of the world?
Well, apparently they rebuilt it largely for New Earth because it was very immobile in the end of the world. I don't think it could do very much. I think they put new hydraulics or something to control.
I like the little touch when he does die, that when he talks earlier in the scenes, his mouth doesn't move at all. There's always the suggestion it's a kind of telepathic field, isn't it? The way he communicates.
Well, he's always been psychic before.
But actually, that's the moment where he's now kind of freed. He's able to breathe the air again.
Yeah.
And actually, his mouth moves to say those final words. Just makes them even more powerful. And obviously, anything with the kind of prophecy in any kind of drama gives it that added depth and pathos. Although what we learn, obviously, the joke at the end of the season that maybe it's actually Captain Jack.
Yeah.
Does actually, even though it's a kind of silly gag,
it becomes a self-fulfilling
prophecy. And actually, you go, the face of Bowman may be billions of years old, but how does he know this? Well, he knows because he was there in Utopia.
I think, unless something happens in Torchwood at some future date, I think we can safely assume that the face of Bow is Captain Jack.
Yeah.
Because he's the most obvious solution.
Another thing I'd say about the face of Bow is I actually kind of think, although it's nice to see him at the beginning of the story and get an extra bit of use out of him, I don't think he really needs to be there. And I think you could have almost like Chip and Cassandra watching, or Cassandra seeing the Doctor and Rose appear in New Earth. You could just have Novice Haim see the
pick TARDIS up a gun appear
and go, Doctor, and pick up a gun, and you think she was still a villain and be sinister.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And actually, the fact that she's working with the face of Bow means you don't think she's a villain.
No, because you know the face of Bow isn't.
And I think we should see that the face of Bow's there and be surprised the same time the Doctor does.
Yeah.
But that's a very minor quibble.
Yeah. It's an episode, as you've said, with lots of pathos in it. I think one bit that I noticed more watching it just now than I have previously is it is very much a story about dispossessed underclass of people who aren't in control of their own lives and their fate's been decided for them by this big parliament. I think it would be going too far to call it a metaphor for modern Britain, but I think there is very much a sense that these people, it's a story about people who have found community and comfort because they're abandoned, but they've built this kind of community, they've built this society where they have their songs and all the rest of it, but they're still not really in control of their own destinies. They're just aimlessly going round and round the motorway. And there's the lovely bit where the Doctor says, drive up, and you might as well be saying rise up, and kind of urges them to go up and take control. And that's kind of what the Doctor does, isn't he? He drops out of the sky, rips down the world and makes people take control of their own fates rather than being powerless and at the whims of others.
And I think you're right. It's a story about that kind of depressed underclass. And Russell does live in Manchester. Wait. I think that's a really good point. And it's part of why the Doctor's frustrated that no one's doing anything.
I think that's a big theme of the Russell T Davies episodes. The Ninth Doctor got criticised a little bit at the time because he was seen as a bit passive, and it was always other people like Charles Dickens had to sort out the plot. But the whole point was the Doctor inspires other people to take control and do something positive.
He's an enabler. About Gridlock, I think it has really good, well-sketched characters. As the ones you see for moments as you charge through, the characters in the cars, as I suppose we should call them, some of them just defined by colour, I suppose, but the white man, the red man, the man with the bowler hats, who's quite fun, the various cat people, Branigan and Valerie, a brilliantly written couple.
They acted really well, and
Branigan's
makeup is astonishingly good. The
Doctor says something about seeing in his eyes, and you go, I can actually see his eyes. I can see that the expression works so well. Ardlo Hannon's performance really comes through. You love that pair within 30 seconds of meeting them. There's something really believable. And given that, to be honest, there isn't something very believable about the whole situation at all, it's an extremely contrived metaphor.
Yeah.
And you know, actually, you do kind of have to suspend your disbelief that people wouldn't just kind of get out and try and walk over each other, over the cars to move 10 miles on. You won't wait 6 years to move.
Well,
but that's part, I think that's part of the Doctor's frustration that
they're just like sheep.
And they kind of secretly know that they can't do that it's not going to work. And the way they all reassure themselves is to just move 20 yards.
Yeah. Although I kind of agree as well. Maybe there is the point that people need to take control of their own lives. But it's very odd that if everyone knows that once you go to the motorway, you never come back. It's very odd that people would still keep on going to the motorway.
Well, partly they're all trapped down there.
Yeah.
I don't quite follow why they don't just live in the Undercity.
Yeah.
But I think maybe the conditions in the... There's nothing in... With the city basically frozen off, actually...
It's the only way to get...
The cars, which will produce food from waste and stuff, are just as good place to be.
Maybe.
And that they think maybe the reason no one comes back from the motorway is they are catching the motorway to a better part of the city to live, and so they don't come back, because actually that's... But it's not they necessarily...
But
only where the stories come from.
I kind of get that, but... I think the stories come from people talking on the motorway.
Oh, yeah, of course.
But I get what you were saying, but why is that girl taking forget if people think going to the motorway is going to a better place? She clearly knows that it's an awful fate.
Once she's taken the forget...
And everyone's really sad.
Once she's taken the forget so that she can forget that her parents are gone to the motorway, because it makes her sad. When the doctor then says, your parents have gone to the motorway,
she says,
oh, that's nice. Why would she say that's nice? She's forgotten so much. She's forgotten the motorway is bad, presumably, because... She should be horrified again.
That was my thought. Has everyone just taken forget because it's easier to forget than it is to live in the knowledge that the only options open to you are either eke out some awful existence in the
Undercity
or go on the motorway?
It's a mix of... Because obviously the people selling those moods aren't on the motorway. They've decided to stay there running a business. But I think that's it. People either take forget or they choose to forget.
Mm.
And they don't need a drug to assist them. They just kind of repress it, particularly after, you know, the Cassini sisters have been on there for 20 years. They're a lovely couple of characters as well, just instantly drawn. And I think both their forenames may be named after characters in Century Falls, and one of them's played by an actress from Century Falls, which I rather like. Is it Alison May? I think Alison May are mother and daughter in Century Falls. Actually, the one moment I feel slightly awkward about, even though... By the end of the story, because the drug, I feel like a virus can't mutate in a drug, but we'll ignore that. The drug is responsible for everybody's deaths and what's happened.
Mm.
The doctor seems a bit, you know, the doctor's not exactly before come out as a massive anti-drugs person.
Mm.
And so he does seem a bit sanctimonious and illiberal when he tells them that he's going to shut down their street. I'm not quite sure how he plans to do it.
Yeah, I think it's the weakest bit of the episode. I think it's...
I don't have a problem with Doctor Who saying to kids, don't do drugs, MK, but the Doctor comes across as a bit arrogant.
Tennant does her shouting through his teeth kind of expression.
It's the only bit of the performance in the whole thing that isn't perfect.
Yeah.
But even... And I was thinking about this as it was getting to the end, and I was thinking how perfect his performance was. But even then, I think he's been asked to do something that's a little out of character, and I think he does it as best... as you could do. I don't think there's a better way you could have played it. I think it's...
I don't know that it's out of character. I just think it's... Because I don't think the Tenth Doctor's ever been backwards about telling people what he thinks they should do.
Mm.
I think that's one of the character's flaws, is that he has a very set idea of what he wants people to do or not to do.
Yes, and actually rising up can free them, but it also can mean they have to do what he says.
Yeah. He's meant to be angry at that point, I get that.
Yeah.
It feels slightly contrived to give David a moment where he's angry at these nasty drug dealers rather than actually flowing naturally from the story.
Right? And it's right...
He's meant to be going in rescuing Martha.
And it's right for him to say that the moods probably are bad, you know, a bad thing, but my hopelessly liberal streak says, well, that's fine. It's better if people don't use them. If they do, that's their business, really, rather than his.
Yeah.
So, legalised moods. I think it's beautifully directed. My favourite bit is that little, what I assume some kind of crane shot, when the... Also vertical storytelling, when the car's taken off that's kidnapped Martha, and the Doctor's just kind of shouting at it, and the camera just goes up and follow his eye lines.
Yeah.
Following up is a lovely shot. The way that the motorway is realised is rather cool and has some lovely moments. And just the design of the whole thing as well, that kind of grubby design, you really kind of feel the grubby reality of New York.
Yeah.
So that's Gridlock.
Yep.
Which I think we liked.
Yes, very much.
A really, really lovely piece of Doctor Who. Right, let's ask the randomizer which season to taste next.
Okie doke.
And the answer is... Ooh, that makes a change.
Right.
We have one Doctor left that we haven't watched anything from, which is the Fifth Doctor, and that's going to remain the case for now. His three seasons remain untouched. We are, however, returning after a little absence to the Fourth Doctor.
Okay.
And it is season 15.
Oh.
You mean, yay! So, yes, not maybe the Fourth Doctor's finest run of stories, so we have... if I remember, in transmission order, The Horror of Fang Rock, The Invisible Enemy, Image of the Fendal, The Sun Makers, Underworld, and The Invasion of Timmy. Time.
Yeah.
Six stories from which to choose. I will start by crossing one off the list.
Yeah.
I don't want to watch Underworld. I think it's ironically underrated, but it is the story I think I've seen most recently of any of them, although that was a long time ago. It was the first time I'd watched it, but it was only a couple of years ago, and it was alright, underrated, but I didn't want to revisit it.
I don't think I've ever managed to sit through it again after the first viewing many years ago on VHS. I've never watched it on DVD. It's a deeply boring story.
My pitches for the others. Horror Fang Rock, I think, is widely regarded as the best story of the season. I've never actually been a massive fan of it, but...
I think week on week it's a very effective bit of kiddie tea time horror for tots, or whatever Mary Whitehouse would have called it. I think it's very much in... of a piece with the Philip Hinchcliffe stories.
It has that kind of Edwardian Victorian style to it.
I think it is very effective. I think it's a lot of people's favourite stories, and I can see why. It's not really near the top of my list, but I think it is very good.
The Invisible Enemy is another one that's slightly notorious.
I love some of the ideas in it, but the execution... The big problem with season 15 is Graham Williams...
Doesn't have the money.
Doesn't
have the budget handling.
And it all seems to have gone belly up the minute he took over. And I'm sure he was a subject to a lot of external factors around budgets and all the rest of it, but some of season 15 is barely competent. In fact, it's not competent. And
The Invisible Enemy is inner space done with the money from the adventure game, isn't it?
I think season 15, I think for the first 14 years, you can look at individual stories and say, well, the design on that's slightly dodgy. But I don't think ever before you can look at a season and say that season as a whole is significantly worse in production values than the season before. I think there's a steady upwards trajectory to season 14, which looks pretty stunning. And then you get season 15, and it's like... everyone has given up trying to make the show competent.
And as I said, it's possibly because part of making season 14 so good was Philip Hitchcliffe spending all the money before he went.
And
then the BBC going, you can't have as much money now.
I agree. So as I said, there are lots of reasons.
But you're right, it does just look cheap.
It's unarguably worse than season 14.
Image of the Fendal.
Boring.
It is, isn't it?
It's really dumb. It's the kind of story that on paper I should love. It's almost...
It's the stone tape type setup,
Nigel
isn't
Neal-ish,
it?
A creepy skull, horrible kind of M.R. Jamesy, slimy strange monster.
But it ends up just being a lot of walking around and talking in rooms.
On paper, it should be one of my favourite stories ever, and yet every time I've watched it, I've just thought, oh, plod, how long till the end of the story?
And it doesn't have, even though like the local non-scientist family are quite fun, it doesn't have that memorable hook. The Sunmakers is...
The one that we should watch.
The Sunmakers is Robert Holmes, which always a plus point. A satire. It's not exactly the most exciting story in the world, being all about tanks.
It's not exactly the most exciting, but I think it has a very acerbic quality to it. It's very witty. And
it's a very Blake Seven-y story, isn't it?
It is incredibly Blake Seven, but I think it's probably funnier than anything in Blake Seven. And it's got the
Collector?
The Collector, or whatever his name is, who's a lovely performance. It's Henry Wolfe?
Yes, Henry Wolfe, Heinz Wolfe is one of them.
And Tom Baker, and he apparently just loved working with each other. I think it looks as cheap as The Invisible Enemy, more or less, but it's just a much more confident and fun story, despite that.
Underworld we've discounted already, and The Invasion of Time, which is by far my favourite story of the season.
Yeah, it's very likeable. It's probably... I don't think it's as good as either Horror Fang Rock or The Sunmakers, but I've always enjoyed it.
In the favourite versus best dichotomy, I can kind of accept that probably objectively Horror Fang Rock or The Sunmakers is the best story of the season, but my favourite is Silly Old Invasion of Time. It's quite exciting. It has a lot of running around, things happen, there are plot developments, the Doctor seems to be doing something naughty. Yeah, Gallifrey looks a little bit cheap, but and the ridiculous bit leader at the end, the TARDIS looks oddly cheap with its Paradise Tower-style swimming pool. The Suntarans look wrong.
Yeah. It's one of those stories where the ideas are fantastic, but they feel rather squandered on an end of the season. Oh my god, the money's run out, spectacular.
Whereas they wouldn't be squandered on an end of the season finale, which is what it should be. It should be the climax.
You know, going back to Gallifrey, big event, the Doctor potentially selling out all of the Time Lords to facilitate an alien invasion. Wow, that's quite big. But then the aliens turn out not to be the Daleks. They don't even turn out to be the Cybermen, who are obviously the B-list version of the Daleks. They turn out to be some D-list monster from the kind of people vaguely
I think
remember.
That's slightly unfair. They were in two or three seasons earlier, and the Suntaran experiment is a slightly odd Suntaran. We've never had more than one Suntaran before, have we?
Well, we've never had one that's not Kevin...
Lindsay.
Kevin Lindsay. The whole point of Lynx and then...
Is they're clones.
Is that it's Kevin Lindsay and he's brilliant.
Yeah.
I think when you've got... Is it Derek Deadman or someone?
Yeah, from Time Bandits.
I think when you've just got these... The Suntarans in themselves...
All right, Doctor! Boring,
when you've got someone like Christopher Ryan as well, that kind of makes them fun, but they are...
Or even Dan Starkey. Dan Starkey is the new Kevin Lindsay, isn't he?
Agreed. But they're unusually dependent on the actor playing them, which is strange for a monster, but absolutely, I think the Suntarans only work if there's a decent actor inside them, whereas the Daleks and the Cybermen, obviously the people who operate them are very skilled, etc., but the monsters are good enough in themselves that they have a kind of wow factor, whereas the Suntarans don't.
We may yet come back to the Suntarans. We have some more seasons that they're in to consider. The Invasion of Time is, of course, the only story in the season that's six episodes. Everything else is four. We always say it's not a criterion, but it obviously is to some extent because we have limited time to watch them. As much as we'd like to watch the maximum amount of Doctor Who in our lives as possible, I think we'll go for one of the four-parters, and I think, therefore, there's a reasonable consensus we'll make it the more fun one, which is The Sunmakers.
Okay, I was willing for you to persuade me to watch The Invasion of Time.
Well, let's watch The Invasion of Time then. It's tricky. I know The Invasion of Time quite well. I've only seen The Sunmakers once or twice. I'd rather watch the movie. Given a completely free choice, I'd much more enjoy watching Invasion of Time, because I think it's a jolly good romp. So it's up to you. I will go with either. I'd rather watch the Invasion of Time.
I think The Sunmakers, I love the novelisation. I think it's Terence Dix wrote it, but it's really pacey, and it's got this really nasty bit where Leela's going to be steamed to death, which always struck me as being particularly horrible.
No, none of these things in the novelisation is a selling point for watching it.
but also it's got the Ysirians, who are quite cool monsters. It's got the Doctor inciting rebellion and being a bit of a rockabilly punk.
I'm imagining that Robert Holmes was going, oh god, I just had a tax bill through, and in order to pay this off, I'm going to have to write another Doctor Who story. Wait.
So, and I've probably watched The Sunmakers a little less than The Invasion of Time, so
you'll watch it 50% less because it's only 4 episodes.
Yeah, I'm still interested in The Sunmakers, but I'm willing for you to persuade me a bit more towards The Invasion of Time.
Well, I think we have already watched. Have we watched Robert Holmes? The Crotons?
Yeah, we watched The Crotons, didn't we?
Yeah, and The Invasion of Time is actually Graham Williams, isn't it? Is it under the David Agnew name?
David Agnew is Anthony and Reed and
Graham Williams. So, I do think it's got the most interesting story of any of them. I think the idea of seeing Tom playing evil,
yeah,
or pretending to play evil, is quite fun. Even within the confines of being stuck in Gallifrey, it's kind of epic. And even on its low budget, it's kind of epic. I think Leela gets plenty to do, because she's kind of separated off from the Doctor and has to go and make her own way. we have the Vardans as well as Santarans, so we get two aliens for the price of one.
Yes.
I said The Sunmakers was really Blake 7, didn't I? It's got Villa in, hasn't it? Not only is it like... Does it look like a Blake 7 story? It's actually got one of the Blake 7 regulars in it.
It's got that kind of...
Factories.
Budget on location look to it, yeah. Lots of corridors on location. But then so is The Invasion of Time, to be honest. I think it's quite Blake 7 when they're running around inside the TARDIS.
Yeah.
It's just a swimming pool somewhere and, you know, some factory somewhere.
I'd be interested in looking at seeing these rubbish Santarans again. I do like Barusa in it as well.
Barusa is pretty good in it. Okay then, you've persuaded me to reluctantly not watch The Sunmakers, because that's the one that I was gunning for.
I think you wanted to be persuaded all along.
Yeah, that's what you said in court. But...
So we'll watch The Invasion of Time then, and we'll let you know how that goes. Bye!
Bye!
Know what a stupid fool you are!
I really need the toilet. Oh, my wife, I would like to use your toilet.
Oh, James Bree.